I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Inspired by the Welsh myth of the Blodeuwedd, a woman created using flowers and plants, author Bar Friedmantel set out to create her own version of the story in her debut novel, Honeysuckle. The book opens with two siblings, a sister and a brother named Wynn and Rory, who are several years apart. Frustrated by his endless demands to play, Wynn crafts a playmate for Rory, a Blodeuwedd, which Rory names Day. As Rory grows up, Day is recrafted and renewed each season, and the power dynamic between the two shifts and begins to take a more sinister turn because Day, as a Blodeuwedd, must always do what her creator requests. I recently spoke with Bar Friedmantel about Honeysuckle and the Welsh myth of the Blodeuwedd that served as her inspiration.
Honeysuckle is a very loose retelling of a story from Welsh mythology, and it's about a girl made of flowers who must be rewoven at the end of each season or she'll fall apart, and a lonely boy who will do anything to save her and stop the cycle of bloom and decay, including a lot of things he really shouldn't.
I was unfamiliar with this myth of the Blodeuwedd. Where did you develop an interest in this mythology?
So my first encounter with Welsh mythology, I think like a lot of other people my age, was through Lloyd Alexander and the Chronicles of Brittain, which is very loosely based on Welsh mythology. And it took me years to realize that it's even connected. But I was also always very fascinated by myths and folklore, and pretty much magpied anything I could get my hands on. And when I was, I think, in high school, I came across the Mabinogion, and it felt a bit like coming home because I grew up on the names, and I absolutely fell in love with the story of Blodeuwedd. It's so pretty, and it's so imaginative, and it's so full of everything. But it also never sat well with me that she was framed as the villain. In the story, a girl is made out of flowers to be a bride as a way to overcome a curse that prevents her husband from taking a human wife. And she's later turned into a bird, to an owl, as punishment for choosing a different love and a different life. And the fact that she was framed as the villain, despite never having any choices or any say or any agency, even over her own body, like it's changed first from flowers to woman and then from woman to bird. And it really fascinated me, and it really stayed with me and resonated with me.
So your novel, Honeysuckle, is set in a different world where there are some elements of magic. And obviously the Blodeuwedds are magical. And at the school, you know, one of our primary characters, Rory, attends, it's implied that he's learning magic in some of his courses. But other than that, the magic is really subtle here. I mean, there aren't any crazy magical things going on, and life seems really pretty ordinary. I mean, there are payphones and answering machines. Talk to me about how you decided upon setting and just how much magic would be a part of this world.
I think the type of fantasy or the type of books I often gravitate toward are the ones that have a world with a twist, where you have some element of magic, but it's not seen as magic. It's seen as commonplace, seen as science in this book. And that way, when everything else is the same, when it's the same experiences that we have, the same relationships, it's just the cascading ripples of this one change. I think the really cool thing is that magic, the fantastical, can be both what it is and function as a metaphor, function as a way to talk about things that we experience every day, but from a different angle, or like from tilting them on their side and seeing what happens. And I really love the freedom that it allows us and how it opens up so many doors that we are tired of opening usually.
So in Honeysuckle, the Blodeuwedd was created for Rory, a young boy who was 8 at the time, by his older sister Wyn, and he called her Day. And although Day is not human, she still deals with some of the challenges that human women endure, particularly when it comes to safety around men. So talk to me about the importance of giving Day some of these human experiences.
I think it was very important for me to walk the line between human and not human, but for her to be human enough for her to explore power dynamics and relationships that everyone goes through. Because while Honeysuckle take it to the extreme, that how much the power dynamic is skewed to one side, how one side is actually responsible literally for someone else's life. I think every relationship has its own type of power imbalance. It's never 50-50. It's not ever perfect, not consistently, not in the long run. And I really wanted to explore that, what happens there and what happens when you take it to the extreme. And because of that, it was very important for Day to be human or as human as possible in the way the interaction affect her, in the feelings it creates, even if her starting point is very different.
You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about the theme of consent, because as it is explained, the Blodeuwedd has to say yes to whatever is asked of her by the person who created her. And when creating Day for Rory, she was basically creating a playmate for him as an 8-year-old, because she was tired of him bothering her. And so she created this playmate who would always say yes to skating or to climbing trees or to running or swimming or what have you. But this relationship went on for a decade. She had to be rebuilt every season. And Rory figured out how to continue to build her, how so she wouldn't fall apart when the seasons changed. But as Rory's classmates observe, and as Day herself observes, there's that imbalance of power going on in their relationship. And even as Rory is aware of it and thinks about it often, Day's consent is sort of glossed over, isn't it?
Yes. And I think much of what the book deals with is the question of like where the line of consent goes. How much can you stretch it before you're on the wrong side? And how delicate it is sometimes, because Rory is aware that in theory, she is supposed not to be able to say no, but he still manages to convince himself that it doesn't apply. At first, because his sister is the creator, so she can say no to his sister, not to him. And later, because she's his best friend, he loves her. He has a whole relationship with her. It's impossible for him to imagine that she's forced into it. And the lengths he goes to convince himself that it's not the case and to convince himself that the relationship is balanced and that she has a choice and to try and give her a choice as well. He actively tries to give her a choice while also taking it away from her. I think this is really because consent is in the real world. Consent is a lot of time it's just violated, which is awful and horrible, and this is the world we live in. But there's also this line that we walk through in relationships with the people we love, where the violation is not clear-cut and where it happens in such slow increments that it's really hard to catch the moment you trip over it. And I really wanted to capture that and to have people like think about what it means for them and what how it resonates with their experience and how it makes them rethink their own relationship, hopefully.
You know, another ethical concern that the book dips into is that of the elements of nature that are killed in order to create new life. And I don't want to, you know, give any spoilers here, but talk to me about the idea of sacrifice of the natural world for an artificial world.
I haven't really thought about it from that angle, from the ecological angle, because it's not so much sacrificed as changed, as forced to take a different form. And for me, that was another way of control, of taking something that doesn't belong to you and shaping it to something else without consent. And yeah, it's pretty hard to ask for consent from flowers or from forest animals, but it's another layer of at what point do you trip over the boundary, where the boundary lies. Is it there? I was very, very, very curious about this concept of like where the line passes. And I think I, without realizing, just chased it in every way I could.
I read in your short bio that you wrote your thesis about Victorian vampires, but there are echoes of a different monster here. Maybe not the monster, but the creator, Victor Frankenstein. So to me, your novel also serves as a cautionary tale about the responsibility of creators, dangers of unchecked scientific ambition, the need for love and companionship. Can you touch on these ideas and do you see your novel as a cautionary tale?
I definitely see my novel as not so much a cautionary tale, but a stop sign, if it means anything, like a request to pause and think about what it means to be responsible for someone else, or what it means to take responsibility for someone else, and what kind of obligations and dangers it creates. And I'll be honest, I wasn't thinking of Frankenstein as I was writing it. I made the connection after I finished all the first draft and second draft, and I was like, huh, yes, that makes sense. But during my degree, I had to write a really long essay about Frankenstein, and which meant reading it really in depth. And it was, I think, a couple of years before I started writing Honeysuckle. So I think it was still fresh in my mind in some way, even if I wasn't realizing it at the time.
As I was reading, I felt a turn in the book. You know, I witnessed when Rory's definition of home changed from where he grew up and where Day remained, but then he began to refer to school as home. And for much of the book, Day anxiously awaited Rory's return, but then she began to dread it. Can you talk about where this shift occurred?
This, as much as it's a story about the relationship, their relationship with each other, it's a story about growing up and discovering who they are separately and the ways that a relationship that was very, very important to them was pulling them back and holding them and preventing them from being other people, as a lot of relationships that are so symbiotic can be, especially at that age. And the funny thing is, I think I put more of myself in Rory than I put of myself in Day. How anxious I can get, or how much I'm sure that it's my responsibility to take care of everyone and that I know best how to do it. And I really wanted, as much as a lot of readers have very, very strong feelings toward him, I really wanted for him to have the space to grow up. And that could only be separately. The same for Day. He couldn't become her own person as long as he was her only definition, was Rory's companion. She had to be alone to become, to grow, to become herself. And that was so painful for both of them, but I also think that it was the best thing that could happen for them, if it makes sense.
Well, Rory, as a boy, was a barely parented child. We never see the parents. They're not around. And then the tutor leaves and another one does not replace him. So, what kind of effect does that have on Rory to be so self-sufficient at a young age?
I think it makes him, on the one side, very capable, but on the other hand, very, very afraid. Because when everybody leaves all the time, the only thing you can do is clutch at the things that matter to you as hard as you can for as long as you can, in any way you can. And I don't think Honeysuckle in any way tries to excuse Rory's behavior, but I do think it tries to understand it as much as possible. It's not so much hurt people, so it's okay. but to understand what makes him tick and why he behaved that way, why he clutched A so hard. That's partly because that's the only way he knows how to function. Because when leaving is the reality, you'll do anything you can to prevent it.
In this world, many constructs. A construct is like day. It's something that is created for a purpose. And many constructs were created for like mindless jobs. There was probably no reason for this, but I kept finding myself compare these constructs in Honeysuckle to AI in our world. Did you ever have that thought as you were writing?
Oh, no, I did not. I think I finished the first draft just before the explosion of ChatGPT and the likes. And my husband is a computer science professor. So at the time, he was like, this is not AI. This doesn't count before all of it. But I do think I was very much trying to explore the line, like where the line of between something you can use and something you need to ask permission for goes. Where do we place the line? Because there's the automatons, but Freud also creates a lot of animals as a way to practice before he starts rebuilding Day and as he tries to find ways to make her last longer. And I think Day keeps asking herself, what is the difference between them and me? It's just the shape. It's just the shape and goodwill. And I think this is something that I don't have an answer to, but the novel do questions of like, how do we decide where to place the line? And why do we decide to place it there? And what it says about us.
I did notice, I mean, you wrote from two different character perspectives. We would hear from Rory in some chapters, and we would hear from Day in others. And I'm curious about finding the voice for each one, especially because in the beginning, most of what we heard was from Rory, but then there was that turn, and we would hear primarily from Day toward the end of the book. Can you talk to me about capturing each of those voices and when you needed to shift to have one voice more prominent than the other?
I think it took me a while to find it, but in general, Day tends to be more embodied. He tends to see the world through experiences rather than thoughts, if it makes sense. And the filter through which she sees the world is the natural world, the things around her, the things that she gets to experience. And I really tried not to hit readers on the head with it, but to make it a thread that goes through her point of view as a way to separate both of them and the way each one of them sees and communicates with the world. So yeah, I think having different, slightly different perspectives on the world, that they view everything as more embodied and as more filtered through the natural world and her metaphors are filtered through the natural world. She sees a picture of a city for the first time, and her point of reference is a forest. But also, I tried to mirror the level of how conscious she is by how long her chapters are. And the more she comes into herself as Rory starts to disappear, as she has more years, the longer her chapters grow and the more frequent they are until there's more of them than there are of Rory's. So I tried to make them separate in these ways.
Can you talk to me a little bit about your writing process?
I was writing it while I was living like 5 minutes walk from a forest. It was during my husband's postdoc, and we were living in the IAS in Princeton. So the Institute Woods was actually outside my door, like. And every day I would go outside for a walk or for a run. So, and I would see deer and rabbits and birds. And I think they found their way into the landscape of Honeysuckle. I had a very thriving bird feeder, and the personalities of the bird in the bird feeders are 100% the personalities of the birds in the book.
So Honeysuckle is your debut novel. What's next for you?
Is it okay to be a secretive goblin?
Absolutely.
It always feels like when I'm still writing, it feels, I think it's a metaphor that Maggie Steve's author used, that she's holding a whole bunch of balloons. And like every time she looks away or looks at one balloon, another one goes away. And that's the way it feels talking about something I'm still writing. Like I'll say this about the plot, and then like the balloon of like how the sky looks will go away, or I'll forget that there's a sister.
Okay, so back to this book then. Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from Honeysuckle?
I think the thing I love most about books is how personal they are, how they are first and foremost an experience, something that happens in the space between the reader and the book, and it's not something you can replicate, and it's not something you can predict. So anything that they'll take from the book will make me happy because it means that they made them theirs. But if I could choose one thing for me, it would be if they'll ask questions, if they'll finish the book and ask themselves how they feel about the relationship between power and consent and agency, and if it made them question anything or if it made them feel anything, that I will be ecstatic.
Well, the book is Honeysuckle. Bar Friedmantel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Honeysuckle by Bar Friedmantel was published by Bloomsbury. Joining us now is Kate Late, the founder and owner of Paper Cuts Bookshop in the Jamaica Plain neighborhood of Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to Marginalia, Kate.
Thank you so much for having me, Beth. I really appreciate it.
So, what do you have on your stack for us today?
I have so many books I'm always excited about. I've been a bookseller for 20 years now, and one that I'm super excited about is written by a fellow bookstore owner, and their name is Jules Wernersbach. The book is called Work to Do. They own a bookstore called Hive Mind Books, and it's a queer independent bookstore in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And it's this amazing little book about a grocery store co-op and the characters that are there. The author themselves has worked in retail, in bookstores for 2 decades, and just the experience of these characters, like you feel like you know them, they jump off the page. And I always admire a bookstore owner, especially having time to write a book. I don't know how they do it. Another one I just finished reading by another independent bookstore owner is called Shut Up and Read by Janine A. Cook. And she is the founder and owner of Harriet's Bookstore. And I was so inspired by her story and her inspiration, of course, based on Harriet Tubman, and that she channels Harriet throughout her book. And I found it, being a bookstore owner isn't the sanest career choice. And we do it for all sorts of different reasons. And listen to the book and really just do what the title says. That's all we need to do for a little while each day. Another book that I'm excited about, who I think is an honorary bookseller because he used to live in my neighborhood. And when I started back in 2014, I was very understaffed. And I had this customer come in, and he would kind of come in every week and sort of like sniff all the books in a way that just, I could tell he was a literary person. He was a little shy at first. And then we got to talking, and he told me he was Andrew Martin. And his first book was Early Work, and it came out from FSG in 2018. And it is wonderful. It's about young people figuring things out, making mistakes. And he's just got this sense of humor that cracks me up and puts a smile on my face while also seeing the humanity in everything. His latest, I just finished yesterday. I could not put it down. It's called Downtime, and that's a recent release. I think also from FSG. And it's a book about five friends as they're growing older and they're changing and they're trying to become authentic with their own desires and vulnerabilities. And it's really funny. It's got some kind of sexy parts. I think he's one of the best writers working these days, a little underrated. So check him out, Andrew Martin, all of his early work. And then Cool for America, short story collection, and Downtime is his latest. Speaking of people that come into my store and tell me that they have books coming out, years ago we did a book with Benoit Denison Lewis, and it was called Travels with Casey. It was about his dog, and he took a trip around the country, a solo road trip with his golden retriever after a breakup. And it was a beautiful story where he interviews people along the trip, and he just gets to know, people and their dog relationships too. And we did this lovely event where Casey was actually at the event, the dog, and it was so special. That was maybe 10 years ago now. Benoit has a new book coming out now called You've Changed, where he has just interviewed the most interesting people. He's a journalist, he writes for the New York Times Magazine. He's a lovely human being. David Sheff said about it that it's endlessly thought-provoking and inspiring. And it's true. It's about we all change, right? And people, you can hear it in fiction, but this is a really cool nonfiction, just interviews with people who have really changed their lives in profoundly different ways. And those shifts, I don't know, it felt for me that I think it makes us all unafraid to change our lives a little bit when we know other people have done that. A book that I got really excited about a couple years ago, it's called Dirtbag Massachusetts by Isaac Fitzgerald. And he actually grew up the same place where I'm from, which is North Central Massachusetts. And there's a new book that he has coming out soon called American Rambler, Walking the Trail of Johnny Appleseed. So Johnny Appleseed was from Leominster, Massachusetts, and I was also born in Leominster, Massachusetts. So I've always known the story of Johnny Appleseed growing up. And if you don't, it was the legend of a man who wore a pot on his head, and he planted apple seeds all along the north and the northeast. And Isaac Fitzgerald takes a hike through the woods, and he meets people along the ways. He goes into the philosophy of Johnny Appleseed, which is fascinating. There was also a graphic novel written a few years ago called Johnny Appleseed that is more about the complex character that he was. So Isaac Fitzgerald is a fantastic writer. He's a lovely human. I saw him do Britney Spears' Toxic at karaoke once. These are just like they're real people writing real books. And I just, that's what excites me about being an independent bookseller and being able to see a little bit behind the scenes. Just a few books I'm really excited about that are coming out later this year. One is called American Hogwan by Min Jin Lee. She's the author of Pachinko and Free Food for Millionaires. And I got to see her in Pittsburgh a couple weeks ago. And she is one of the most remarkable humans, writers. She interviews everybody. She knows how to write characters. And that's a book that I'm just digging into now. And everyone should be super excited about that one coming out. Pre-order your books from your local independent bookseller. And The Glorians, Terry Tempest Williams, I adore her. This is out now, and she just gives me hope. She's really inspired by her dreams and the small things that we can do to find some glory. And a Glorian is an unknown thing that came to her in a dream. And I think that we need to dream ourselves a new future, and books are here to help us with that.
Well, this is fantastic. You have given us so many books to think about. And this conversation has been edited for time, but you can find the entire conversation on our website at kmuw.org. Kate Late of Paper Cuts Bookshop in Boston, Massachusetts, Jamaica Plain neighborhood, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Beth. Happy reading.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Maybe you already know about naked short selling. Maybe you've personally shorted stocks yourself. But do you know about the time short sellers ruined a Super Bowl, basically?
For me, I was a little late, but red flags went up like, what is going on? This is really scary.
At Planet Money, we get the story behind the money to explain how money works. Listen on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts.